Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Michelle Alexander demolished the notion of a post-racial America when Barack Obama was just a year into his first term. In January of 2010, Alexander published her first book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. She argues the country has found a new way to suppress people of color, especially black men, by creating a harsh and disproportionate war on drugs. Black men have been incarcerated at much higher rates and much longer durations than whites for drug offenses, despite similar rates of usage. Perhaps the most important statistic Alexander's research has revealed is that there are more black adults under correctional control, including prison, jail, probation, or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War started. The New Jim Crow became an unexpected bestseller with over 1 million copies sold to date. A 10th anniversary edition, including a new author's preface, was published this January, and she joined guest host Eric Spanberg last November to discuss what has and has not changed since her groundbreaking book was first published.
Michelle Alexander, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with the basics here, the title of your book. When we refer to Jim Crow, we're talking about the era roughly from the end of Ulysses S. Grant's presidency to the civil rights era of the mid-1960s, correct?
Yes, roughly.
And so in your book, obviously the title says it all, The New Jim Crow, you really pursue this idea that what we've seen with mass incarceration is a furtherance, if you will, of what was happening first with slavery and then with Jim Crow. Could you begin by just giving us a little insight into how you developed this idea and then eventually turned it into a book?
Yes. Well, you know, when I published The New Jim Crow, Barack Obama had just been elected president and our nation was awash in post-racialism, this kind of euphoric sense that we had overcome, that we were, you know, now overcoming our racial history and systems of racial and social control were part of our past, not our present, and that we were kind of finally on the right path, perhaps not having arrived at the promised land, but well on our way. And I wrote the book inspired by my years of experience representing victims of racial profiling and police violence and investigating patterns of drug law enforcement in poor communities of color. And what I had learned from that experience blew my mind. I came to see that this drug war that we had declared was not a war on drugs, but a war on entire communities based on race, and that millions of poor people, overwhelmingly poor people of color, had been swept into our criminal justice system, branded criminals and felons, and then stripped of the very right supposedly won in the civil rights movement, such as the right to vote, the right to serve on juries, and the right to be free of legal discrimination in employment, housing, access to basic public benefits, and more. It became clear to me that although we were now embracing the rhetoric of colorblindness as a nation, that in practice we had done it again, that we had managed to rebirth a system of racial and social control eerily reminiscent of those we had supposedly left behind. One of my goals in writing the book was to help people to see that this system of mass incarceration that had been born in the United States, a system unlike anything that exists anywhere else in the world, this system did not simply control those who were locked in cages, in prisons and jails. This system of mass incarceration was accompanied by a system of legal discrimination against those who had been branded criminals and felons. against all those with criminal records, authorizing legal discrimination against them for the rest of their lives. And it was this larger system, not only of caging people at a rate and on a scale unlike anything else in the world, but also by relegating people who had been swept into the system into a permanent second-class status and stripping them of voting rights and the ability to participate in democracy, that this larger system, made us unique in the world, and also brought us back full circle to a time we supposedly left behind.
Now, as you mentioned, when your book came out, Obama was early in his first term as president. We had yet to endure the tragedies of Trayvon Martin, the Ferguson riots, Eric Garner, and so many others that have followed. Given that context, given the events in Charlottesville, some of the racist views espoused by the current administration, how would you compare 2019 with 2010 in terms of social justice and equity?
Well, in 2010, in so many ways, I think our nation was still asleep to the fact that old-fashioned racism and white nationalism still existed in America. The politics of white supremacy had been driven largely underground, and we're still operating, through our criminal justice system to target, people of color, particularly black men, for drug crimes, even though they are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites, and, sweep them into the system. But back in 2010, the politics of white supremacy were subterranean, more beneath the surface. It was extremely rare for people to say openly and proudly that, they want to take America back to some period of time that we had left behind. And yet here we are, less than a decade later, and the politics of white nationalism and white supremacy are on display. What had been driven underground has burst forth. And, some view it as ironic that our nation has reached a bipartisan consensus regarding the need to downsize our prison system somewhat at the very same moment that a wave of white nationalism has swept across the United States. But if we look closer, I think we'll see some real parallels between the moment that we're in right now and when the drug war was first declared. Back in the 1980s and the early 1990s, the media was awash with stories about black drug users, crack babies, the so-called crack whores, and there was a virtual media frenzy about the post-crack epidemic and super predators that discredited, notion that there was going to be a generation of, young black and brown men that were going to terrorize the nation. We were awash in fake news that justified, punishment far more severe for crack versus powder cocaine. It was a wave of fake news that resulted in harsh mandatory minimum sentences being passed for even tiny amounts of, marijuana or crack cocaine. And we had politicians across the political spectrum demanding that we build more prisons, build prison walls. And today, we have a president who is, slandering immigrants, calling them rapists and murderers and terrorists, arguing that they want to come steal Americans' jobs and arguing that we need to build more walls, this time border walls rather than prison walls. But the same politics of fear-mongering and scapegoating and race-baiting in attempt to appeal to poor and working-class whites. You know, back in the 1980s, there was a deliberate strategy. The so-called, you know, Southern strategy of trying to appeal to poor and working-class whites who felt threatened by or resentful of the gains of African Americans in the civil rights movement with get tough rhetoric directed at African Americans. And here we are decades later with, again, you know, there being white racial anxiety around shifting, you know, racial demographics due to immigration. And we see once again, the resurgence of this kind of fear-mongering and scapegoating and demonization and calls for the building of more walls and massive investments in law enforcement to control and to protect us from this unwanted, supposedly unwanted population. So as much as things have changed, and I know for many Americans, the election of Donald Trump feels like whiplash, having gone from a liberal black president who was preaching the virtues of multiculturalism and diversity to a president who says we need to make America great again by returning to some time that we left behind. There is much in American politics that has remained the same. And what I think is dramatically different is that the politics of white supremacy that had been driven underground have burst once again to the surface. And this is a cycle that has repeated itself throughout American history since the abolition of slavery.
We're coming up toward the end of this first segment, so I'm going to have to limit your answer a little bit to this question, but I'm curious, although it sounds like a completely stupid question, and it may be, there are some who say that having these views in the open, as repugnant as they are, that, you know, somehow it's better to at least know what we're dealing with collectively as a society. What do you think of that idea?
I understand that. Many of us feel, oh, it's just better to know where people actually stand and to be kind of speaking their views out loud rather than hiding them or them operating on an unconscious level. And it is true that unconscious bias and racism can be as damaging as, you know, white supremacy when it is out in the open. In fact, I argued in my book that the entire system of mass incarceration is largely attributable to these fears and biases being exploited and manipulated and capitalized on, even though they were not often expressed out loud. However, the problem with white supremacy being so public and being championed online and through social media in the way that it is that it can be contagious.
We'll return to the rebroadcast of our discussion with Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, right after this break. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is Michelle Alexander. She is the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Michelle, before we went to the break, you were offering your thoughts on the, I guess, not only the damaging effects of having racism out in the open, but how that spreads, how that proliferates. Go ahead and continue your thought.
Yes, I was just, you know, saying that although it, you know, can be helpful in some respects to know where people actually stand by sharing their views out loud, that racism and white supremacy can be contagious, particularly in social media environments that kind of operate as a closed circuit where people find themselves, you know, exposed only to videos and articles and sources of news that confirm their biases rather than challenge them. And when you see white supremacy and white nationalism kind of gaining steam in an environment in which many people refuse to expose themselves to sources of news, sources of history, sources of information that might challenge these, you know, biased, distorted, and extremely dangerous ways of viewing and engaging with the world, we have a potential recipe for disaster. We have a situation where, you know, white nationalism can spread like wildfire, and where people who might otherwise not be receptive to these kinds of messages find themselves exposed to them and digesting them and sharing them with others, not fully understanding or appreciating how harmful and how wrong they are. And so I think it's important for us in this time to stand up and to speak out and to organize both against kind of the open, above ground forms of bigotry and white supremacy that we see today, while also remaining equally vigilant about acknowledging the forms of unconscious bias and unconscious racism that has animated systems like mass incarceration and mass deportation, and that exist within all of us to some degree. There is no way you can be raised in the United States of America without having been influenced to some degree by our nation's history and legacy of racism, and having, you know, absorbed through osmosis to some degree biased views about people of different races. And that is why we cannot just point the finger at those who are obviously and openly blatant and biased. We must also kind of look at ourselves, look within, look in our own families and communities, and ask ourselves, what are we doing to reach across all borders and boundaries of difference and to respond to one another with greater care, compassion, and concern rather than an attitude of pure punitiveness? For it is that spirit of punitiveness rather than a spirit of justice or care or concern that has made the system of mass incarceration possible in the United States. And it is that tendency to view some people as disposable, as unworthy of any care or concern, that is also leading to calls for border walls and astonishing rates of deportation.
You mentioned the president. He recently spoke in South Carolina, about an hour and a half from where we are in Charlotte, at Benedict College, which is an historically black college. And as part of this event, he received the Bipartisan Justice Award for passing the First Step Act. Here's a portion of what he had to say.
4 years ago, 20 African-American Republicans and 20 African-American Democrats founded the 2020 Bipartisan Justice Center to advance the cause of criminal justice reform. And I'd heard about it for so long, and it was going nowhere. But they all got together, and you fought to fix a broken system. You sought to confront inequality and stop injustice. and you work to restore hope and optimism where they are really needed the most and where there was very little.
Now, before I get your perspective on that, I should mention the president made those remarks in the same week in which he compared the impeachment investigation to a lynching. And also, as part of that event at Benedict College, Senator Kamala Harris and others protested that the president had been given this award. With that as a backdrop, what's your perspective not only on the award, but the First Step Act that he was discussing there?
Well, I think we need to put this in broader context. You know, over the last 10 years, a bipartisan consensus for modest criminal justice reform has emerged. And this consensus includes people who were former Get Tough true believers like Newt Gingrich, and people who are, you know, championing the drug war and the prison building boom, as well as those who are on the progressive end of the spectrum. And the reason that we suddenly see former Get Tough, you know, true believers supporting modest downsizing in our prison system isn't because of some sudden awakening to the dignity and humanity of those who have been locked up and dehumanized and stripped of basic human rights. No, this kind of sudden inspiration for criminal justice reform began during the economic crisis when states, large and small, realized that they could no longer continue to expand this massive system of caging and incarceration without raising taxes on the predominantly white middle class. So as some states were facing bankruptcy during the economic crisis, conservative governors as well as progressive governors began looking for ways to begin to rein in this massive prison system that they had created. And so it is from that place of wanting to shrink the system just a bit in order to make it manageable for taxpayers without having to, you know, raise taxes on a predominantly white middle class that led to this impetus where you suddenly have people like Donald Trump, who has never shown any, you know, compassion or concern for those who have been caught in the criminal justice system. In fact, you know, this is the same Donald Trump who responded to the case of the Central Park Five, you know, the
yes.
five teenagers who were innocent and yet had been arrested and, you know, convicted of rape as teenagers. He responded to the case of the Central Park Five by taking a newspaper advertisement in the New York, you know, Times, calling for the New York State to adopt the death penalty to kill these teenagers. And he has still refused to apologize or change his position, even though they've been exonerated. So I think we have to view with appropriate skepticism Trump's commitment to a truly just justice system. The First Step Act has afforded the release of a relatively small number of people who have been convicted of nonviolent, particularly drug offenses in the federal system. And of course, you know, any legislation that allows for people who are, you know, locked in literal cages simply for drug offenses is something that I think we ought to all applaud. I personally believe that the simple possession of drugs should be decriminalized in the United States, as it has been in Portugal. And in Portugal, they've seen, you know, significant reductions in drug addiction and drug abuse now that they have invested the money that they once spent locking people up for drug addiction, invested it in drug treatment and health care and in preventative services and education. We would be wise to do that, as I see, you know, it makes no sense to incarcerate people who are alcoholics. And
let me stop you there for a second, Michelle. I wanted to read something you wrote that directly addresses this, which is, you wrote, if people who abuse illegal drugs were viewed as people who have real problems rather than people who are problems, drug treatment would be the obvious and rational response, rather than putting people struggling with addiction in cages, treating them like animals, and stamping them with a lifelong badge of inferiority. And I take it from your answer that remains the case.
Absolutely. I mean, it the notion that someone who is struggling with drug abuse or drug addiction would somehow be served by arresting them, tearing them away from their family or any support system, putting them in a cage where they quite likely will not have access to any drug treatment or support, subjecting them to relentless shame and stigmatization, and then upon their release, stripping them of the right to vote, and making it legal to discriminate against them for the rest of their lives in employment, housing, access to education, financial aid for schooling. How could this possibly serve their recovery? We make drugs illegal because we are supposedly so concerned about the harm these substances can cause people. And then we wind up inflicting far greater harm, a lifetime of harm upon people who use these drugs because we're supposedly so concerned about them and, you know, hoping to protect them in some way. This is nonsense. And I think the reason our drug policy has become so insane and just irrational and counterproductive is because the drug war was never really a war about drugs. The drug war was declared for reasons that had more to do with racial politics and partisan politics and an attempt for, you know, conservatives and former segregationists to show how tough they were willing to be on them. Those who had been defined as the enemy in the media, you know, then it has to do with actually trying to solve the problem of drug addiction or drug abuse in this country. And we have paid a heavy price. You know, in 30 years, drug convictions and the number of people serving time in prison for drug offenses increased more than 1,000%. You know, in 30 years, more than 30 million people were arrested on, you know, drug charges alone, taken from their families, locked in cages, and then stripped of basic civil and human rights, relegated to a permanent undercast. For decades, this drug war has been focused almost exclusively on poor communities of color, particularly ghettoized communities. But in the wake of the opioid crisis, growing numbers of white people have been locked up as a result of the drug war. And in many ways, you know, they are the collateral damage of the drug war. The drug war was not declared with them in mind, but they and their families are now suffering terribly because of our nation's commitment to incarceration and control rather than investing in drug treatment and in the well-being of our families and communities.
That's the voice of Michelle Alexander. She is the author of The New Jim Crow. We talked earlier in the hour about President Donald Trump and the Republican administration. Let's talk about President Bill Clinton, former First Lady Hillary Clinton. You wrote a blistering critique in The Nation in 2016 about the policies that he backed and passed, Get Tough on Crime, Three Strikes and You're Out. I want to play you a portion of a speech where then-President Clinton is talking about taking steps to curb youth crime.
So we say this, the gangs may run to another state, but they cannot hide, and they will find it tougher and tougher to escape the law. Second, we are proposing legislation designed with valuable help from the U.S. attorneys here, from local law enforcement officials and lawmakers, especially Senators Biden and Cole and Congressman Schumer. Our Anti-Gang and Youth Crime Control Act of 1996 will use the very same strategy our crime bill used to make the juvenile justice system tougher and smarter and to help our young people stay drug-free and away from guns and gangs and violence.
When you hear that, and we're coming up toward a break, can you just give me a quick snippet of what you think, and then when we come back on the other side, I'll let you go in-depth about the Clinton policies.
The problem with the Clinton policies was that he escalated, the Clinton administration drastically escalated a drug war against the poorest and most vulnerable communities at the same time that his administration was also slashing funding for welfare and public housing and making it even more difficult for those communities to survive. I think we all know that the safest communities in our nation are not the ones with the most police or the most prisons. They are the communities that have the best schools, the greatest access to jobs, and where people have access to health care and drug treatment and counseling and support systems so that when they are struggling, they have the support they need to be able to get back on their feet and not only survive, but thrive.
When we return from the break, Michelle Alexander will dive into the impacts of President Bill Clinton's crime policies, as well as North Carolina's own public safety issues, on Charlotte Talks with guest host Eric Spanberg.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and my guest today is Michelle Alexander. She is the author of The New Jim Crow. When we went to the break, Michelle, you were talking about President Bill Clinton and some of the contradictory policies and laws he endorsed and passed as president. I'll let you finish your thought.
Well, you know, I don't even view his policies necessarily as contradictory. I view them more as a capitulation to a right-wing segregationist narrative on how best to respond to struggling communities of color. You know, after the civil rights movement, you suddenly had segregationists who could no longer say openly, segregation forever.
Mm-hmm. Instead, this is kind of the Lee Atwater, right? The Lee Atwater manifestation.
Yes. And so you had segregationists begin adopting the rhetoric of law and order and get tough on them, on communities of color. And it first began with civil rights protesters, segregationists portraying them as outlaws and people who had to be reined in and gotten under control. And then with the Black Panther Party and the Black Power movement, they fanned the flames of fear that there was going to be some kind of violent insurrection among Black communities and that we needed to get tough and crack down on them. And then as many inner city communities began suffering from economic collapse, a literal depression, as factories closed down and began to move overseas, and as technological innovation rendered many of the jobs that poor and working people did in inner city communities. I mean, remember back then, back in the 50s and into the 60s, factories would be located in inner city communities in urban areas so they could have easy access to cheap black labor. But as those factories closed down, those work, that forms of work disappeared, those inner city communities suffered from economic collapse, poverty rates skyrocketed, crime rose, and we could have responded to, you know, this crisis in these communities with economic stimulus packages, with bailout programs. We could have responded to these communities with a wave of care, compassion, and concern. But instead, former segregationists said, no, we must get tough on them, the others. And they railed against the welfare mothers and the so-called crack babies. And unfortunately, this narrative, this scapegoating and fear-mongering and demonization of poor people of color struggling to survive in communities where work has disappeared, became bipartisan in nature as the South began to slip from blue to red, and Democrats began worrying that they were going to lose their majorities, and in fact were losing their majorities in many states as a result of the Southern strategy of appealing to poor and working class whites through not so subtle racial politics. And the Clinton administration, when it chose to invest billions of dollars in prison construction.
Yeah, you quoted somebody who said this was... Didn't you quote someone, a sociologist, who said this, in effect, became the de facto affordable housing program, that poor people were really just shuffled into prisons because all the money was spent building prisons rather than housing?
Exactly. Funding from public housing was slashed. Clinton vowed to end welfare as we know it. And so it wasn't so much that his policies were contradictory, but they reflected what was happening in the Democratic Party generally, as there was a collapse of resistance across the political spectrum to a right-wing segregationist narrative that
communities
did not deserve our care and concern. They needed us to get tough on them.
I meant contradictory in, and you mentioned this in your essay, from the standpoint that the late Toni Morrison, you know, had declared him the first black president. He and Hillary have both had this long-running rapport with black voters, obviously, but black churches. You know, he was viewed as someone who was very open on race, and yet this is what he did.
Yes, it is what happened. And, you know, again, I think it's important here to acknowledge that, you know, Bill Clinton, I'm sure, you know, he has many black friends. I'm not denying that he is someone who has cared about black people and has friendships with people who are black. And in fact, his presidency, you know, resulted in the hiring of many black people to high-ranking positions within his administration. And that paradox or that irony is part of what I explore in the New Jim Crow, that during this period of so-called colorblindness, we saw that even progressive politicians or those who claim to be progressive politicians, those who were Democrats and who had been, you know, were perceived as allies of black communities and who were, you know, hiring individual black people into positions of power, were also kind of caving to the politics and the tactics of white supremacy by adopting a purely punitive approach to poor communities of color at the very same moment that they most needed our care, concern, investment, and support. And by ratcheting up the drug war and investing billions in prisons and police surveillance at the time when Our schools needed massive investments. I mean, think of it this way. We have spent more than $1 trillion since the drug war was declared. $1 trillion on the drug war. And yet communities of color are always being told that there's no money to pay good teachers. There's no money for early childhood education. There's no money to invest in public housing. There's no money for your drug treatment. Yet we had $1 trillion to blow, locking people up for drug offenses and subjecting their communities to constant police surveillance and control. And this is what I think we need to wrestle with, you know, as we face kind of this, the challenges of the Trump era, that it is not enough to get rid of a single president, Donald Trump. We need to finally overcome the politics of white supremacy. And by that, I want to be clear what I mean. It is the politics of fear-mongering and racial scapegoating and pitting poor whites and working-class whites against people of color and encouraging to imagine that they are the problem and the enemy, and that if only we get tough on them and get rid of them by building prison walls or border walls, that then we can go back to a time when America was not a place in which white supremacy felt contested. And it's the politics of white supremacy far more than any individual president or politician or any particular set of rules or policies that we need to overcome. Because as we've seen time and time again in this country, we have a habit of birthing enormous systems of racial and social control. After slavery, Jim Crow arose, and then we had the ghettoization of people of color in Indian cities, followed by mass incarceration, and now we have mass deportation and border walls. It is the politics of white supremacy that keep us pitted against one another, blaming and shaming one another, rather than reaching across all lines of difference to build a democracy and economy in which every voice and every life truly matters.
And I think what you're getting at, you are obviously one of the featured experts in Ava DuVernay's 2016 documentary 13th, which is about mass incarceration, but also what you're talking about, which is this long history of racial politics and pitting working class whites against minorities. I think you're getting at this idea of reconciliation, restorative justice. You've written about that, what's going on in Rwanda. Obviously, Brian Stevenson at the Equal Justice Initiative has been vocal about the need for America to really confront its past and its present in terms of racial strife and segregation. And that's a long way of me asking you, what's your sense of the collective willingness to do that?
I think many of us are very willing to do it. What we may not be ready for is the depth and breadth of the work it requires, right? Many of us want to overcome these politics and are weary of them and want so much to be behind them, which is, I think, part of what Obama's, you know, early appeal was. You know, he was preaching hope and change, and, you know, I think many of us kind of wanted to leap into this colorblind future in which we could just elect a black president and kind of carry on without having to reckon with our racial history and our racial present and the fact that we had already birthed a new system of racial and social control that would have to be dismantled. And so I think there are many of us who are not only very tired of Donald Trump as president, but who are committed to birthing a new democracy a truly inclusive, egalitarian, multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy grounded in the awareness of the dignity and humanity of us all. But we've got to be willing to do the work. And I'm grateful for Bryan Stevenson and the lynching memorial that he made possible in Birmingham. And I think we're going to have to do what Germany and Rwanda and South Africa and other nations have done when it has been necessary to face directly our racist and bigoted and violent past, face it honestly and squarely, and educate our young people not only about what happened in the past, but how it is manifesting in our present and what is necessary for us today to ensure not only that nothing like slavery or Jim Crow ever happens again, but that we begin to respond to those who we view as the other, those who we have labeled criminals or those we have labeled illegal immigrants, those who we have viewed as disposable, as fully human, fully worthy of our care, compassion, and concern, and dismantle the existing systems of racial and social control that we have today and invest the billions of dollars that have been invested, reinvest the billions of dollars that have been invested in exclusion and dehumanization and control and begin to rebuild the communities that have been harmed most so that we can create a democracy and a new economy that has room for us all. I think that there is a majority of Americans who want to build a truly multiracial, multiethnic, inclusive, egalitarian democracy, and yet we don't necessarily always know how to begin. But we can begin right where we are in our communities. I know a lot of work is being done in Charlotte to wrestle with the past and the present and begin difficult conversations and the difficult work of learning how to dismantle systems of control in the communities that we live right where we are. Systems of racial social control cannot be dismantled through, you know, one sweep of the pen by a president or one ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court. It requires people in every community, in every state, being willing to look at themselves and one another and the communities in which they live and ask, what does it require of us to dismantle these systems of control and reimagine what justice can and should mean today?
That's a good place to leave it. I should mention Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, was banned by the North Carolina prison system. The ACLU appealed that, and in January of 2018, it was restored for prisoners to be able to read. You almost can't make this kind of thing up, but we have to leave the conversation there. Michelle Alexander, thank you so much for joining us today on Charlotte Talks.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to an encore edition of guest host Eric Spanberg's conversation with Michelle Alexander from last year about her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. This was the last episode of our Charlotte Talk series, Revisiting America's History of Racial Injustice. You can find today's episode and more on WFAE.org. Thanks for listening. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.